Well, hello, friends, and welcome to a special episode of In With The Old. My name is Tim Howe, and I'm joined today by Peter H.W. Lau, who is an Old Testament scholar and author of the book that's going to be under consideration today. I'll show you a picture of it there. His new commentary on the Book of Ruth in the Nicott Commentary Series. Dr. Lau, as you know, in With the Old, we went through the Book of Ruth verse by verse, and your text was incredibly helpful, both to Brian and I, and I'm excited for this conversation as we just think about this incredible book of the Bible. And so I want to dive right in. And before we get to the Book of Ruth proper, we'd like to ask every guest this simple question. When it comes to the Old Testament, the Old Testament has fallen on hard times, at least in many ways in the West. And so what is it that drew you to the Old Testament as an object of study? How did you come to love and study the Old Testament?
Yeah, just in response to your question, it's not just in the West that it's fallen to hard times. I think we were in Malaysia for 8 years teaching at a seminary, and I did find that it was neglected in Malaysia as well, so not just the West. Yeah, but in terms of how I fell into the Old Testament, I guess by God's providence, I grew up in a Christian family. And so I got to enjoy and read the Bible. But then as I went through, I realized I needed to know more about the Old Testament. I needed to find out more, especially about narrative. And even when I went to seminary, I'd finished my 3 years at Bible College, Sydney Missionary Bible College, but I still felt that I wasn't confident in preaching Old Testament narrative. And so I thought, I need to study it more, think about, you know, how can we bring out ethics and moral teachings from the Old Testament in a way which is, you know, honoring to Christ and pointing to Christ and bringing glory to God. And so that's why I did further studies on Ruth.
Okay. Well, excellent. Thank you very much. And so let's dive into the Book of Ruth then. Obviously, you wrote a whole commentary on the book, which is an incredible accomplishment. But if we could just boil it down, what are a few key things that you would alert readers to as they approach and engage with the Book of Ruth?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I would suggest three key things to do as you're reading Ruth. One is to just put yourself into the story. So try to put yourself into the sandals of the original audiences. Try to see things through the eyes of them as well as the characters, because often we see things through what happens to characters. And I guess try and feel the emotion. So I think this happens naturally as you, you know, listen to narrative, but, you know, there are some things we can try to do. Second thing is, I think, try to be attentive audiences. I found that when I listen to your podcast, that's exactly what you guys are doing. So it's fantastic. So just, you know, trying to pick up repeated words, even repeated phrases like, you know, under the wing, which often points mm-hmm. to God's providence and answering a prayer. And then also try to pick up if there's any links to other parts of the Old Testament or the New Testament as well. That's the second thing. So first is put yourself in the story. Second is be attentive audiences. And the third thing is, I mean, God is the main character of the whole Bible, including the Old Testament. So try to see, how is God working in this narrative? You know, he's only mentioned once explicitly working at the end, but, mm-hmm. you know, think about, how is he actually working through the rest of it? Is it through the characters? You know, where is he? So I guess there are three things I would suggest.
Yeah, I love all three of those, and we feel the passion of the narrative. We feel the pulse of the narrative as we consider the characters and what they're going through and how God is shaping them. But one of the things I love about your commentary is the attention to detail, and especially in a book like Ruth, every detail is important. There's nothing that the narrator includes that isn't absolutely crucial in understanding the intention. And so I love your emphasis on that, and you did a great job of that in the book. Could we maybe talk for a moment about the honor and shame elements that we see in the Book of Ruth? How do you see honor and shame working itself out, both in the characters and then also in the plot?
Yeah, this is a good question, because I think it has been neglected in previous studies of the Bible. And I think if we think about honor, shame is in all our worlds, even America, Australia, where I am at the moment, but it's also prominent in Malaysia, where I was teaching. It just, I think it's just expressed slightly differently. And I think we need to be in touch with that, because I think there's just honor shame ideas and worldview and motifs in the narrative. And if we don't pick those up, we don't, I guess, fully understand or fully appreciate what's going in the narrative. So let me just pick up honor and shame in terms of the plot. And then I'm going to focus on one character, which is Naomi, because I see her as being the central character. So in terms of honor, shame, the plot is actually U-shaped. So a U like this. And so the beginning of the U is where Naomi has honor. She says in chapter one that she left Bethlehem full. Now, I think what she means by full, she's full of honor, if we can think of that in like that terms, because she has a husband and she has two sons. But then by the end of chapter one, she says she's empty. She has no husband. She has no sons. And she's back, as a childless widow, which is a shameful thing in that day. And she's come back with Ruth the Moabite. That's also shameful. How can you bring back, someone from Moab? Anyway, so that's the bottom of the U. But then there's a reversal starts. The turning point is when she does return, that word shuv. And so she's returned. And then through Ruth and Boaz, who happen to be honorable characters, they're presented as honorable characters in the narrative, then the U starts to shift, reverse. And then towards the end, Naomi is once again full of honor, but this time it's a little bit higher. So that's why I say it's a U-shape plot, but the second half is higher. Because now Naomi has a son, which is strange because it's not actually her son, it's actually Ruth's son, but the women of the town say it's her son. And the son is not just any son, becomes a grandfather of King David, which we find out by the end of the narrative. So that's how, one way we can see honor shame. But honor shame, the whole thing is shot through with honor shame motifs and ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with your contention, Dr. Lau, that in so many ways, it's under the surface, but it's assumed. It's assumed that the original readers would understand how shameful, say, Naomi's return would have been, and then how impactful her restoration and redemption would have been. And I think we see that with Boaz protecting Ruth from shame. I think we see that even in the terms of Ruth the Moabite and the author not hiding that, but highlighting it, or even the phrase at the end when it says that Ruth is better to Naomi than seven sons.
Oh yeah. That's a huge honor for both, especially Ruth, because at the beginning Naomi had two sons, but then she has no sons, but now she has one foreign daughter-in-law, who is now described as better than seven sons. That's just, that's mind-blowing in a sense, but yeah, that's nice. That's a nice sort of parallel that we get from the beginning to the end.
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you this, Dr. Lau, one of the things that I, again, appreciate about your commentary was the way that you analyzed the structure of each individual portion of Ruth. I thought that was a real strong point. And then, of course, seeing that kind of beginning with honor, but then losing it and then coming back to an even higher point. Very good. So as we think about the factor of ethnicity, another feature of the Book of Ruth is the repetition of this phrase, Ruth the Moabite. I believe as I look through it, she's explicitly referred to as Ruth the Moabite five times, and then twice she's just referred to as a Moabite. So it's seven times, which could be significant. But this is throughout the book. So maybe you could talk to us a little bit about the importance of this label, Ruth the Moabite, and why we should pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's a good question, Tim. And I think when I listened to your podcast, you guys did bring out this idea of Ruth the Moabite, the Moabite, the Moabite. Why does it keep on being repeated? We as an audience only need to hear it once. we already know. So what's going on here? Like, there must be something that the author is trying to bring across, right? So in a sense, as we're saying, it's redundant. So it's for emphasis. So what is that emphasis? It's interesting how the very last time she's referred to in the narrative, she's just Ruth. But the two times before that in chapter four, she's still called Ruth the Moabite. And that is actually by Boaz at the legal scene at the town gate. I think it's to point out to original audiences and also to us a couple of things. I think one, I think it's, in a sense, it reinforces Israelite identity. And I think that's the case because Ruth, as a Moabite, almost, you know, paradoxically, displays kindness as a virtue more than other people. And then she's also described as a worthy woman or a worthy wife in 3:11 by Boaz. And that is a link to Proverbs 31. So that's describing the ideal wife or worthy woman, whatever you want to, however you wanted to translate it. And so, so almost paradoxically, this foreigner is displaying to Israelites how they should be in terms of kindness and being a worthy wife. I think in a sense, it also counters stereotypes of what they might have thought Moabites were like. So they were probably seen as promiscuous or, you know, going back to Lot and his daughters and how, you know, how those nations were formed. That, you know, Ruth's Moabite identity in this narrative sort of counters that as well. I think, so that's one, reinforces or counters ideas. Secondly, it challenges Israelite identity as well. So who can be a member of God's people? Is it just a descendant of Abraham? Or can it be other people, foreigners who worship Yahweh, foreigners who, you know, pledge their allegiance and loyalty to Yahweh? So I think that's what the narrative is saying as well. It's those people, those who trust in the Lord, can also be part of God's people. And we can almost see it in reverse. So was Naomi still a member of God's people when she left the promised land? Was she still trusting Yahweh? In which case, you know, that's almost like the opposite of what of Ruth is doing.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. And as I think about this, and Dr. Lau, for our audience, you and I know we've already recorded this episode and are re-recording it. And so I was thinking about our last conversation and something that you mentioned, Dr. Lau. But as we think about especially the book of Deuteronomy, and how Deuteronomy speaks about a lot of different things, but one of the things it says in Deuteronomy 23 is that none of the descendants of the Ammonites or Moabites may enter the Lord's assembly, even to the 10th generation. In fact, in a sense, Deuteronomy really reserves some of its most rigid and harsh language for Ammonites and Moabites. Which, as I considered that, really presents the importance of not ethnicity, but there are Moabites and there are Moabites. You know, there are those who turn away, and this is in Ruth chapter 1, she turns away from her people and her gods. And even though others are going to still see her in terms of her ethnic identity, God knows better, and God is going to treat her differently as his daughter, as a daughter of the covenant. Even before the people kind of catch up to what God already knows. But here was my thought, Dr. Lau, in terms of that 10th generation thing in Deuteronomy 23, how incredible is it that, as you mentioned, the great grandson of Ruth, the Moabite, ends up purchasing the land for the temple, and her great great grandson is the one who builds the temple. And you know, that's well within 10 generations. So it to me, you know, and maybe you can speak to this, we have to choose, don't we? Are we going to read Deuteronomy in light of Ruth, or will we read Ruth in light of Deuteronomy? And as you mentioned last time, I think it helps us to understand that maybe the stipulations we see in Deuteronomy aren't quite as exceptionless as they might seem on the surface.
Right. I think in terms of the one that you mentioned, Deuteronomy 23, we can actually look at the intention of that one as well. So the principle underlying that one. So for example, Deuteronomy 23:3, no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Now listen to this. Because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. So if you look at the underlying logic, it's because the Moabites did not show hospitality. In fact, they were trying to curse Israel. Now, what happens in the book of Ruth? It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. So when God's people go on it's almost like another Exodus, Elimelech and his family, they're not met with inhospitality. they're not met with cursing, but the opposite. So when they went there, they're actually blessed and they're shown hospitality. So if you're looking at the logic underlying the law, it's actually short-circuited in a sense. So in this case, you could argue that it doesn't apply to this Moabite because she had actually fulfilled the, you know, the, I don't know, underlying logic of the law, or maybe the spirit of the law. So in short, I don't think we can play, I don't think necessarily need to play off the narrative with the law, but I think the narrative helps us to see, you know, how we apply the law. You know, what is the underlying logic? What is the principle? What is the reason behind it that God has? And then we can actually see that being played out in the Ruth narrative.
Yeah, I love that, Dr. Lau. And I think when we consider even the chronological setting, it was the time of the judges when every man did what was right in his own eyes. You have here a reminder that God has a remnant among the Israelites and Boaz, but even among the nations in terms of Ruth. And and that helps us set it in canonical context as well. And we'll get to that in just a second. But let me just ask you this. When it comes to a study like a commentary and the depth of work that goes into that, you do so much study, there's probably a lot of surprises. So what would you say were maybe some surprises that you found as you studied the Book of Ruth and then wrote the commentary?
I mean, I guess one of the surprises is chapter 3, but we'll come to that. We'll come to that soon. But another surprise is what you were mentioning already. Like, what's going on here? Like, I know the law in Deuteronomy or Exodus or wherever says this, but what's going on here? Why is Boaz marrying a foreigner? You know, what's Boaz doing, pulling out stalks from the field to when it says you just need to harvest to the edge and leave the rest? But he's like pulling out stalks. So one big question for me was like, what's going on here with the law and the narrative? I mean, is it because it's a different genre, a different type of literature that, you know, we can just sort of, you know, change the application of the law? But as I said before, I think it is really showing how ideally the law can be applied in a specific situation. And the fact that you can't have laws that cover every single aspect of life. And so sometimes you need to draw these principles and think about specific circumstances. How are we going to apply it in these specific circumstances? So we did talk about the gleaning law. We've already mentioned that. We've talked about how Ruth is accepted into God's people and, you know, how does that relate to Deuteronomy 23? And also, like, intermarriage. I mean, Deuteronomy 7, Israelites aren't supposed to intermarry with Canaanites. But what's Boaz doing marrying a Moabite? And I think that's related to what we were talking about before in terms of her, you know, pledging allegiance to the Lord. So this is an exception, or this is different. And I think that's what's happening in Ezra and Nehemiah as well, but that's a different topic. So the other thing is, so one of the big issues about Ruth is redemption and levirate laws. Are they separate things, or even is the second one happening in the Book of Ruth? Is levirate custom or the law actually taking place in Ruth? There's a huge debate about this. But the way I see it is, so I think long and hard about this. I think the redemption of the property at the end has to trigger the levirate. Why? Because if you look at the underlying logic of the levirate law and redemption law, it's to continue the name of the dead on his property. So the name and the property has to go together. So if you redeem the property without having a name with it, that is the son, to continue on the property, it doesn't work. So that's why I think in this case, the redemption triggers the levirate, because the levirate is going to produce a son who's going to continue the name of the dead, Elimelech and his son Mahlon, on the property. I think that's why it has to happen this way. I won't say any more at this point, but I think it's worth being.
Well, and tied to the continuation of the name, it comes back to that idea of honor, right? We don't want to shame, or and the tying in of land as well. Land is their means of wealth. It's their means of survival. And so to take care of the wife, to honor the community, to honor the man. And again, that's one of the things that as we read through the Book of Ruth, we need to see how those ideas tie together. So I love that. So the threshing floor, this is a major issue in the Book of Ruth. And for good reason. There's a lot of different issues. There's translational issues that are going on here. There are issues of idiom and euphemism. What is said? What is implied? So maybe you could just briefly walk through one of these, the most difficult passages in the book. What happened or didn't happen on the threshing floor? And why is this important?
So this is one of the most difficult, or one of the more difficult chapters of the Bible. I mean, but the thing is, every time I teach it in terms of Bible study or preach it, no one ever loses concentration there. So, what's going on here? I think we need to break it up into two. So in terms of Naomi's plan and then Ruth's execution of the plan. So firstly, the main question with Naomi's plan is, what is her intention? Was her intention just to put Ruth out there to say, well, actually, the marriage is not with me, but with Ruth, and so everything was, you know, clean above board? Or was Naomi's intention actually something like entrapment or seduction? Mm-hmm. Now, we might think that's just a modern idea, you know, 21st century, that's, you know, par for the course. But actually, if you look at Exodus 22:16, it actually says, if a man seduces a girl of marriageable age who is not engaged to be married and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. Mm. So people are thinking, is Naomi trying to apply this law? Is this another law that's, you know, going to be applied in a narrative context? Is Naomi trying to get Ruth to have sexual intercourse with Boaz, and therefore he's forced to marry her? So this is what people think. So that's the first thing. Is that her intention? And secondly, what actually happens on the threshing floor? I mean, I think it's the whole chapter is just full of sexual innuendo. There's full of wordplay. Even the location and the time, the threshing floor, after the harvest, in the middle of the night, beyond the city walls, it's often associated with prostitutes. So was Naomi trying to send Ruth and, you know, in the middle of the dark, Boaz can't see what's going on. Maybe she'll be mistaken for a prostitute. I mean, the whole thing is just full of sexual tension. And then, like, I think, as you guys said in the podcast, there's just so many double meanings, words with double meanings that are often taken sexually. You know, go in, lie down, feet. I mean, the feet is often a euphemism for the genital organs. So are we talking here literal foot, you know, the one below the ankle? Or are we talking, you know, the groin area? I mean, so is she supposed to uncover up to the groin or just up to the knee? Is she supposed to lie down at the feet or on his foot, if you know what I mean? So what's going on? It's very difficult, but I think at the end of the day, I personally think nothing happens. I think everything is above board. There's no sexual intercourse taking place. The reason why I think that's the case is because for it to take place would not be consistent with the rest of the narrative. It wouldn't be consistent with the presentation of Ruth and Boaz as virtuous characters. I'm not sure about Naomi. That's a little bit separate. But also would make a sham just like not valid, the whole thing that takes place on the next chapter, because the whole thing is to do with marriage. And if she's already had sexual intercourse with Boaz, then it's almost like a rubber stamp on what happened the night before. And it doesn't look like that's what's taking place to me at all.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Dr. Lau. And I'm convinced by your arguments in the book, as well as the ones we've talked about. And again, after we talked and thought about it a little bit more, I think there's even more evidence for that in chapter 4, whenever the blessing of the elders is very specific, where she says, may your house become like the house of Perez, the son Tamar bore to Judah. Uh-huh. And so you have these stories in the background of Lot with his daughters. You have Judah and Tamar in the background, but I really think they're meant to be foils of what happened at the threshing floor.
Exactly.
So that, especially as you think about the Bethlehemites, right? I mean, they are people of Judah who literally descended from that act between Judah and Tamar. And so they're not unfamiliar of the real world, but here we have, you know, this couple, and of all the ironies, you have a Moabite who would have been known for those things. And yet you have Boaz, who is a virtuous man, and Ruth is a virtuous woman. They do it the right way, and therefore God does bless them. He does, he explicitly says, the Lord opens her womb and she conceives.
That's right.
Yeah, I think that's excellently stated.
Let me just go back 1 second. In terms of Naomi, I sort of left it open, but I think I think within an honor shame culture, I don't think she would have wanted Ruth to uncover his genitals, and I don't think she would have wanted Ruth to lie on top of that region. It just doesn't make sense. Like he is their patron. He's shown so much blessing to them already. Why would she do such a thing to shame, you know, a relative of Elimelech? Just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. In fact, I think that even the idea of going at night, going in secret, going with a clear presentation of marriage, but still leaving it in his hands, I almost think that it was calculated, but it was calculated to give him a true out if he decided not to.
Yes.
In other words, she was trying to protect his honor, not destroy it or take it away.
Okay,
so let's maybe end with this, Dr. Lau, and if there's anything else you'd like to talk about, of course we can, but let's try to situate Ruth a little bit in the overall context of Scripture. So how does Ruth fit into the canon? How does it help us understand the Scriptures as a whole?
Yeah. I mean, within God's providence, the story of Ruth fits in really snugly within the original context. Within canonical context in the Bible, as well as within the whole Bible from Old Testament to New Testament. So I appreciated in your podcast how you guys kept on talking about the anarchy of the Judges' time. So we know that Judges is just before Ruth, and all those episodes beforehand, you know, talk about oppression of women and just how everyone just does whatever's right in their own eyes. And Ruth is like a shaft of light within this sort of anarchy, dark times. So it highlights that in such a great way in terms of the English canon, where the Judges follows Ruth. And then Ruth also has links with the next book in the English canon, which is 1 Samuel. And so there's like word linkages to especially 1 Samuel chapters 1 and 2, and also the story of Hannah, you know, how she was previously barren and then God blesses her, which is very reminiscent of what happens in the book of Ruth, because Ruth is also barren for 10 years. We sometimes forget that, for 10 years. And then God, you know, blesses her with a son as well. So within the English canon, it fits in very nicely in terms of the storyline, which is leading to the birth of David. But then also, if we look at the Jewish canon, the way the Jewish Bible is put together, it's in a section which is what's called the writing. So it's not actually in the, you know, historical narratives in the prophetic or prophetic section. It's actually in the writing section. And so it puts it much closer to things like Proverbs 31, which is the virtuous woman that we talked about before, as well as Psalms. Psalms also talks about, you know, the wing, God's protective wing, and also the Song of Songs, which is the love, the love romantic sort of thing, notions. So depending on where we read it within the English Bible or the Jewish Bible, it actually highlights different themes. And I think that both of them highlights different themes, and it's quite nice how they sort of complement each other. So that's the Old Testament. But as we move to the New Testament, we all know that the genealogy doesn't finish with King David. Actually, David's line goes all the way down to Jesus, the ultimate king, the ultimate son of David. And it's beautiful how we can read in Matthew, you know, how Ruth comes out in Matthew's genealogy as well as some other foreign, what I call them, black sheep, almost black sheep of the family, or, you know, it's these skeletons that come out the closet at Christmas time when we look at Matthew chapter 1. So it's very nice that it links all the way through to Jesus. So the narrative storyline actually moves and links through the genealogy through to Jesus directly. But then a little bit more indirectly, we can also think about themes. So if we're thinking about redemption is a huge theme in the book of Ruth, and we see the ultimate redeemer is Jesus himself. And, you know, this whole redemption idea, if we just focus in for a second on the book of Ruth, we have this idea of it's very costly. The people are in great need to be redeemed. It's familial. You know, all those sorts of things, all those themes can tie directly to Jesus. Very costly. We were in great need. We couldn't help ourselves. And then we become family, become adopted into God's family. beautiful. We wouldn't understand this unless we actually looked to see these themes in the New Testament. And then the last thing I guess I would mention in terms of themes is mission. So we talked a lot about Ruth, the Moabite. And she becomes incorporated, accepted into God's people. And I don't know about you, I'm not Jewish, but you might be Jewish. But this whole thing can we see in terms of mission. You know, I wouldn't be part of God's people. But here we see like some glimmers of it in the Old Testament already. Actually, God's heart is for all people to be saved. And so this is another theme that we can see as well.
Yeah, I love that analysis, and especially the tying together of mission, because this is what we see when we think of even the book of Deuteronomy, that I'm going to make a place for my name to dwell, but it's going to be a place that's going to be a light to the nations, or even the idea, you know, of Exodus 19, that God commissioned Israel to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, and he brought them with eagle's wings to Mount Sinai. So you have the same image of bring me under the shadow of your wings. And the resonances, I tend to think of Ruth in some ways in the same vein as the book of Jonah, because the book of Jonah is an indictment upon Israel's forgetfulness. And actually, even stronger than that, the book of Jonah is an indictment on their unwillingness to embrace that mission that God has given them. So, Dr. Lau, I want to give you just any final word that you'd like to say to our audience or about the book of Ruth. That if you have any other works that you're working on and want to let us know about ahead of time, any final thoughts before we sign off here today?
Oh, wow. I mean, just enjoy the narratives. I mean, the Old Testament narratives, as you say, are very sparse and they're very laconic in terms of the detail. Which is great because it gives us space to, I guess, use our imagination in a sense. I mean, sanctified imagination, I guess we can say. We don't go beyond the text, but we try to, like just in our, like we're doing in our conversation today, we base it on what God has actually written there. We try to understand it within the context of their time and the Bible, Old Testament and the New Testament as well. So I think enjoy it. Enjoy what God's given us in terms of the narrative. But also not just enjoy it, for example, as a love story, but also just see what is God doing here? What does it reveal about God? And what might he be saying to us? How might we also apply it to our situations today as well? And I try to do that in the commentary. What I'm working on, I'm just finishing a commentary on Chronicles. So it also leads to the whole kingdom idea, but it's quite different. But that is also a very neglected book. And I just so many things I've learned just looking at it. It's just God's word is just so rich. So it's we'll need hundreds of lifetimes or even more to understand what's going on there.
Well, awesome. We look forward to that coming out. And Dr. Lau, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. And I've enjoyed this conversation twice now, and even more the second time. Yeah. So. Audience, again, if you're studying the book of Ruth, reading a Bible study or reading through the book yourself or preparing for a Bible study, check out Dr. Lau's commentary on the book of Ruth. You will not regret it. And Dr. Lau, thank you for being our guest again today. And to our audience, until next time, stay cool and stay old.